Okay, thank you. First of all, I'd like to thank the organizers for inviting me to give this talk. I have to confess, it's something I've been looking forward to for a little while, and so I saved something special, something I've never presented before. So I hope it sparks your imagination here in the audience, as well as those of you watching it recorded later. This is work on how to do fault-tolerant quantum computing by color code ladder surgery. It's joint work I've done with my student, Kieran Ryan Anderson, who's here in the audience. Feel free after the talk to ask either I or Karen or me about anything that I mentioned in the talk. And also feel free to interrupt the talk at any time. Okay, well, I hardly need to remind this audience why topological codes are awesome. I have a 6-year-old son, and after watching the Lego movie 5 times, I've learned, in fact, that everything is awesome, which is the theme song of the movie. But of course, topological codes are particularly awesome. They have very high accuracy thresholds. You can do local quantum processing with 2-dimensional layouts. They have reasonably low quantum circuit overheads, maybe not as low as the ones that Daniel talked about yesterday, but reasonably low. They have efficient decoding algorithms. And finally, you can smoothly interpolate between what desired effective error rate you'd like, unlike concatenated codes, which take big jumps every time you have to concatenate to another level. Those are just a handful of reasons why we like them. And if you do like them, it turns out there aren't that many options to look at. By the Anderson classification theorem, if you're interested in planar topological stabilizer codes and you want to have non-local logical operators, you really only have 2 choices, surface codes or color codes, and that's it. And if you're looking for an infinite family of such codes, the natural place to look are uniform tilings of the plane, and once again, you only have a handful of choices. So for the surface codes, these pictures, I'll be drawing surface codes where qubits are on vertices. So when Kataev originally presented these codes, he put qubits on edges because he was trying to make connections to gauge theory. But I'm more interested in trying to make connections to graph theory, and so I put qubits on the vertices. And besides, like I tell my students, you know, qubits really want to live on vertices anyway. So I put the qubits on the vertices, and when you do that, it turns out that the surface codes are in 1-to-1 correspondence with graphs that are face 2 colorable and degree 4. And the uniform tilings are, there's only 4 possible choices of those, the square lattice, the Kagame lattice, and this 3-4-6-4 lattice. So this notation just means that at every vertex you see, for example, a triangle, a square, a hexagon, and a square. And for the surface codes, as you know, you can make them CSS codes where, for example, on the red faces, you define an X-type check that acts like poly X on all qubits incident on that face. And every green face, you make it act like poly Z on every qubit incident on that face. But the coloring is really just decoration. You can do the so-called Levin-Wen transformation, if you like, and make every check the same, where every check looks like just like X, Z, Z, X. And so the checks are uniform everywhere, and the coloring is just to sort of guide the eye. You can do that for any of these lattices. The color codes, similarly, also kind of have this uniformity. So they're defined on face 3 colorable degree 3 lattices. And again, you only have 3 choices if you want uniform tilings. And for these codes, we define, we'll put qubits on the vertices again here. The checks are all X's and all Z's for each face. So there's 2 checks per face instead of 1 check per face. And the features of this graph allow you to guarantee that every face has an even number of vertices, so those 2 checks will commute with one another. I use the word check instead of stabilizer generator because I find it much easier to say. I guess, what did you do, Daniel? I hear you. This is how I guess you do checks in Canada, right? So here, I'll use this. So we've got the... So the checks are for each possible face that we've got there. We've got 2 per face. And so those are the color codes. So we don't have too many options for those. Are there any questions about that? Yeah?
Why do you insist on degree 4?
I don't insist upon it. You mean for the surface codes?
Yeah.
I insist upon it because it has to be that way. So if you take any graph, if you use Kataev's original definition and put the vertices on the edges, and then you create what's called the medial construction of the graph, where you connect every vertex, every qubit, with a line inscribed on every face, then it necessarily is the case that that graph is degree 4. This medial graph construction always gives you degree 4 graphs. The medial graph construction is used in knot theory, for example, when you create projections of knots and things like this. So it's a requirement. You don't have any freedom in that. So if you put qubits on the vertices, then it has to be the case. Except for, I will say that if you have on a system with boundary, there can be maybe some special cases on the very boundary of the corners or something like that. But other than that, it's going to be degree 4.
Okay,
yeah. Yep. Okay, so how do we make logical qubits with these kinds of codes? Well, there are three general approaches to processing logical qubits, and they dictate how you might encode logical qubits. So the first way I'll talk about is the sort of transversal way, where you encode a logical qubit in a surface with a boundary. And again, here, there's sort of funny business that happens on the edges in order to have an encoded qubit. And you can have like a logical x operator, for example, that acts like poly x is going in one direction, and a logical z that goes like poly z's in the other, for example. And for color codes, it's the same thing. So it turns out for surface codes, you need to, if you put it on a surface with boundary, you have to have an even number of edges on the surface. And for color codes, you have to have a multiple of three number of edges for the surface. And you can have along any side, for example, if you do poly x along that side or poly z along that side, you'll get logical x or logical z. And you have to have an odd number of vertices on those along any side, so they'll anti-commute with one another like you'd expect. So any side is fair game for doing it. You can go along this side or that side or that side. You can also deform it to more elaborate objects, which have sometimes been called string nets in the literature, although that's a bit of a misnomer. The word string net is really associated more with this picture where qubits are on the edges and this sort of a gauge theory concept. Maybe it's more correct to call them T-joins using the nomenclature from computer science. Because a T-join is where you have a collection of vertices that have odd degrees. So you could have, like, unlike a matching where you have degree one for the sets of the matching, a T-join you could have degree three, for example, and make a letter T kind of where things come in. Okay, so you can encode transversal picture, you can encode logical qubits in little surface patches. A brilliant idea by Robert Rausendorf and collaborators was to sort of, in an Escheresque kind of way, reverse foreground and background and make a kind of the qubits, associate the qubits with the defects in the surface. And that allows you to work in a planar layout, and you can have like a logical X, say, that connects two defects and a logical Z that wraps around. A single defect would suffice, but if you want to have them untethered from the boundary of the overall surface, you'd use a pair of them, for example. Now, the price you pay for this is, it turns out, in order to create this kind of a region where you have the defects, you end up having to add many more qubits to achieve that. But it allows you to keep you in 2D, which is very nice. And for color codes, you need to use three defects if you want to untether yourself from the boundary. And again, you can have like a loop-like operator that goes around any one of the defects and a kind of this T-join type operator that connects all three, and those two will anti-commute with one another. In the lattice surgery picture that I'll be talking about, it brings us back down to the same kind of qubit encoding that we had for transversal qubits, and it ends up saving in the qubit count. Any questions?
Okay. Do you have a slide in mind in the structure of the gauge group for the color codes?
I'm not going to be talking about the topological subsystem color codes. I'll just be talking about the stabilizer color codes.
Do you have a reminder slide for that?
Other than just this, these pictures, just try to remember that for every face you have, the checks are all X type and all Z type for the faces, and that's it. That defines the code. Okay, so I want to talk about doing encoded quantum logic with these codes. How do we do it? Well, we need to pick a gate basis that we're going to encode, and a particularly nice one is this one that's used quite a bit. It's got this set of stabilizer operations to it and one non-Clifford operation. And the non-Clifford operation is this so-called T gate on the plus state. And you'll notice that the Pauli gates, X, Z, Y, they're not here in the set. You might say, well, that's okay. I can just synthesize those out of these other operations. Well, that's true, but at a deeper level, we don't need even those. And that follows from this Gottesman-Nil theorem. So anytime we would have wanted to have applied a Pauli X, Y, or Z, we could simply propagate it through any of the Clifford circuits in our gate basis until we get to a measurement, and then we can adapt our interpretation of the measurement outcome at that point. So for example, if we had wanted to apply a logical X at some point that we measured in Z, we would just flip the interpretation of what we measured. If we got a 1, we'd say it means a 0, and if we got a 0, we'd say it means a 1. There's no need to actually ever apply these poly X, Y, or Z in the circuit. We can just keep them in our mind classically. And moreover, for the entire gate basis, we don't need to do it. We never need to propagate Pauli through a preparation. They happen after preparations. And so since our non-Clifford operation is a preparation, we can, in fact, avoid Pauli operations in any circuit, even over this sort of non-Clifford gate basis. Now, to be clear, this does not mean that we can simulate these circuits efficiently because we're acting on non-stabilizer states. We have these T plus states, you know, being injected at various points in the computation. And even at a deeper level, you might think, well, maybe I could track what's going on for the Clifford type input or the stabilizer state inputs, but you can't do that either because they, you know, will interact with these non-Clifford operations in subtle ways later that will prevent you from doing that. And I should mention that this argument that says, well, we never need to apply Pauli operators also applies at the physical level of, as well. It's well known that syndrome extraction circuits is sufficient to make them Clifford operators. So we never need to apply physical bit flips or phase flips or products thereof either. Now, that said, you might want to do that because suppose you were doing error correction, you kept identifying where errors were, and you never actually went and flipped those errors back. Then your syndrome bit rate would keep increasing and increasing and increasing because, you know, errors would be all over the place. And that would mean that your classical algorithm that was meant to process those would start taking longer and longer and longer, presumably. Now, to a computer scientist, that's only polynomial time, so maybe you don't worry about that. But you could imagine you'd save a lot of time if every now and again, at least you went in and tried to clean up the errors that you knew what they were at that point versus just letting them kind of accumulate.
Sorry, I don't understand. I mean, all you have to keep track of is the current listed errors.
That's right.
So the history doesn't matter, does it?
It does. So even classically, imagine I just had the repetition code, a whole string, that had, and it started with an encoded zero, and bits, and I started measuring the checks, and most of the time they're zero, you know, if there's no error rates. But then as bits start flipping, I start seeing more and more ones every time I see, you know, a parity check being violated. If I never went and corrected it, I'd start seeing more and more and more and more ones. Eventually, about half of the syndrome bits I measured would be ones. You might imagine it'd be more difficult to decode if I only saw a pair of ones somewhere indicating something went wrong. It might be easier to identify that error for a classical algorithm than if I had a whole bunch of ones and I had to run some elaborate algorithm to figure out what went wrong.
So I mean, you just said what the algorithm was, which is you have, in a separate register, you have keep track of what the current frame is and you adjust your measurement.
That's right.
That's just a very straightforward.
That's right. But you know, you might imagine that the rate of... You might, well, okay, so how do I want to say this? You'd, you might imagine that that processing of, you know, converting yourself to that frame and then interpreting the syndrome could take a little bit longer. I don't know. Maybe, maybe not. Yes,
what
Austin.
What you need to do is detect changes in the measurement problem. So half the little line, half the zero, that's fine. Why it doesn't change, that means how it is.
That's right. That's right.
Don't actually need to go
in. Right. I said that, but I guess before you walked in, I said you never need to correct them, but I said you might want to correct them. But I'm getting a lot of pushback on people saying, well, you don't even want to correct them. Fine. I don't really care. It doesn't really matter. It doesn't really matter. The point is you don't have to, and if you choose to, fine. If you don't, fine. You know, I'm happy either way. Okay, so these words transversal defects lattice surgery, they really refer to the way we imagine doing a two-qubit gate, in this case a CNOT gate. So in the transversal picture, the idea would be that you'd have two kind of planes encoding your logical qubits, one above the other, and you would apply the CNOT transversally between the two planes. That's very low in terms of qubit overhead. It's just two logical qubits worth of information. On the other hand, it sort of in order to apply that in a two-dimensional architecture where all the qubits are laid out on the plane, it would involve a lot of swapping of information to get it from one place to the other because you don't have that third dimension to really come up from the top. And that swapping adds a time penalty because it takes you time to get the information from one place to the other, which eventually propagates to a lower threshold for fault-tolerant quantum computing. For example, concatenated encoding strategies that are forced to work in a plane end up having very low thresholds. And you could trace that back to the need to swap information around. Now, the defect picture is a very clever idea of, well, let's use the voids instead of the surface to hold the information. We can braid objects around in space-time. So this is a picture from one of Austin's papers with this, where each of these pairs of white cylinders are a pair of defects that are moving up in time. And you can use an auxiliary qubit, for example, that braids around these two. This one has a so-called bridge. It's kind of a compact representation of a CNOT gate. And you can do this defect braiding to affect CNOT gates in space-time. And Austin has generalized this for color codes as well, where you use a triple of defects as opposed to a pair of defects. And you can do, again, kind of a elaborate braiding dance to make that happen. Really, the only downside of this is that this uses far more qubits than this picture up here, because you need a lot of qubits just to establish the voids that you're using to braid around one another. So you need to have that kind of region around where the defects are, as opposed to just having the region of where the qubits would have been in the patch of surface itself.
So, why is there a sad face?
It's sad because it uses a lot of qubits. I mean, so this uses like 2D squared qubits. You know, if this is sort of a D by D lattice for distance D code, so you're only using 2D squared qubits. These use on the other 12D squared qubits, say, to do. So it's sad because now I've used 6 times as many qubits that I did before, 4 qubits. So I guess that only matters if you care about factors of 6, but maybe you do care about factors of 6. Now, lattice surgery brings us back down to closer to what the transversal overhead would have been. So we end up having like this in this picture. This is a picture from a paper by Horstman, Devitt, Fowler, and Van Meter, where we have 2 little patches for our 2 logical qubits, and we have to have an extra auxiliary region between, but its region is only the size of 1 extra qubit, so it's only sort of like a few d squared. It's less overhead than the defect-based method, and it keeps us in the plane just like the defect method. So it's kind of like a halfway house between transversal and defect approaches. But there's, it's awesome, I guess, you know, in this Lego kind of perspective, in that it uses very few qubits, and it fits in the plane, but there's an obvious element missing in this chart, which is how do we do this with color codes? And this is interesting, not just because this uses fewer, just because lattice surgery uses fewer qubits than defects, but color codes use fewer qubits than surface codes. So it would seem that this could be the lowest qubit overhead overall to reach a given distance code with topological codes. We're going to find out that's in fact the case. Okay, so let's go through how we do this. So let's start with something simple, the identity gate. How do we do nothing at all? Well, we in both the transversal and the surgery pictures, we just measure the stabilizer generators of the checks d times in succession and send it to our favorite syndrome decoding algorithm. And that'll protect the information fault tolerantly. We do the same thing for the color codes. And the same thing for the defect-based picture in either the surface codes or the color codes. D is going to be the code distance. So I'm going to, in these pictures where I have an arrow with a little letter above it, I'll be measuring things in terms of rounds of measurement. So of course, there's really maybe an elaborate circuit going on underneath, but in many technologies, measurement is the slowest step. So this is kind of a surrogate for measuring how long the circuit would be. You can go through and do the details and be very careful about it, but a kind of a coarse grain first pass. So in order to because we're worried about failures in the syndrome extraction circuit itself, to increase the reliability of the syndrome that we're using to decode, we measure it not just once, but multiple times. And you have to ask, well, how many times? As we heard from Alexei Kovalev's talk, it's sort of like we have a repetition code in time. And if we repeat it, and so the repetition code requires us to give it the same effect, you know, in time as we're giving it in space. We repeat it d times in time. Okay, so it's D rounds of measurement now, no matter how you look at it, in any of these pictures. And I'll point out that in these pictures, I've tried to draw distance 7 examples. And, you know, without any math and even by eye, hopefully you can identify that this is the one that uses the fewest qubits of all of these. Okay, how do we do a preparation? Well, in the transversal or surgery pictures, we prepare a collection of qubits all in, say, the single sigma z eigenstate. So they're all pointing up in the z direction. And then we measure the checks of the code d times. And when we measure the x checks, the only thing that commute with the x checks are the z checks of the code in logical z. So it's necessarily put it in a logical z eigenstate. And of course, we measure the z checks as well to ensure that we correct for errors. And so we can do that for either the surface or color code picture. And that fault tolerantly prepares a known state like a z eigenstate. And we can do the same thing for preparing an x eigenstate as well. For example, we just prepare these qubits initially along the x direction. For the defect-based picture, it depends on whether or not we're trying to make an eigenstate of x or z. We have different protocols for those. So if we're trying to prepare an eigenstate of the string-like operator between these, we basically cut out a patch around the area you'd want to do and replicate this procedure up above and do that for d times. However, if we're trying to prepare an eigenstate of one of the loop-like operators, it's very easy. We just cease measuring that collection of checks because before, we knew that we were in the plus one eigenstate of those collection of checks. So if we take it out and stop measuring, it remains a plus one eigenstate of those things we had been measuring before. So we just cease measuring it, and voila, we prepared the plus one eigenstate of that operator. So it's a slightly different procedure depending on which kind of operator we're trying to prepare. Measurement is pretty much the reverse of what I just drew up there, except you only have to do it for one round instead of d rounds. So this is a destructive measurement in that, so we can just measure all of the qubits individually. It takes us outside of the code space, so we're no longer encoded. And if you don't like that, you can use Steen's trick where you can do an ancilla-coupled measurement where you just take your state that you want to measure, you do a C-naught with it with some ancilla state, and then destructively measure that ancilla state, move it outside of the code, and the effect will be to project the state you want to measure in the code space and make it a polyeigenstate of X or Z, say. And you only need to do this one time because repeating the measurement doesn't help you. You're only as good as your very last measurement. You never know, that very last measurement could have faults in it, and repeating that won't improve matters. So you only need to do one round to do these kinds of measurements. And it's the same case. You just reverse the protocols that I described before for preparation for those scenarios. So the key circuits that are going to underlie lattice surgery, the sort of theoretical underpinning of this whole concept, comes from these pair of circuits, both of which are equivalent to the C-naught gate. These circuits were leveraged heavily by a paper by John Preskill and Panos Alifaris, where they were trying to combat bias noise. And so the way these circuits work is if you want to do a C-naught, you bring in an ancilla state, and you do an XX measurement between, say, the target and the ancilla. Then you do a ZZ measurement between the control and the ancilla. And then you do an X measurement on the ancilla. And you use those eigenvalues that you obtain and do some poly corrections. But like I said, we don't need to actually do the poly corrections. We just keep track of those in our head. And we've done the C-naught gate. In the paper by Horstmann et al., they implicitly were using this circuit here, which does the same thing except it prepares the ancilla in the plus state and does a ZZ measurement. They left out the Z measurement at the end, but I'm sure they meant to do that. That's just needed to clean up the poly frame at the very end. And so these circuits are what we're going to try to mimic with lattice surgery.
I think Daniel used this back in the Dark Ages. He was trying to do
multiple things in a block? Yeah, okay.
I think this things like this were more like in my paper on opponent qubit.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. Actually, a nice exposition of these can be found in handwritten notes that you have on your course website. I did read those, yes. So here's the slide that really kind of conveys the idea behind how we're going to do this with color code. So in both of these pictures, we've got one central qubit, and it's kind of got three different ways. It's got three neighboring logical qubits around it. And I'm going to show you how you do an XX or a ZZ measurement to any one of these possible three neighboring qubits. Remember, there's three sides to a triangle. So we can imagine doing XX or ZZ in any one of the three directions. So this has kind of got like three pictures compressed into one. But I apologize for that. So at any given time, we'll just look at a pair of qubits, the central qubit and a particular other logical qubit of interest. And this is for distance 3, and this is for distance 5 here. So the way we're going to do this an XX measurements, the text here describes how to do it for both X and Z measurements. I'll just talk about the X version here. So what we'll do, let's look at the bigger distance one here. We'll measure only X checks on the light-colored checks along this sort of osculant interface. So osculant is like this fancy Latin word for kissing. You know, it's kind of what we're doing here. And the product of them is going to be XX. So, well, at this very simple example, there's a single, let's say, light blue check. And if you notice that, the X's going around this thing are the logical X because we have X, 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 the three X's on the side. And remember, X along any side of the triangle is logical X. So we've got X bar along this side and X bar along that side. So the check itself is X bar, X bar. In a more elaborate example, if I take the product of these, I have the x's along here, and then I also have one more x at the very end here, and that walks x's all the way along this side here, and all similarly walks x's all the way along that side. If we chose a different color, for example, the green here, it would be x, x, x along this side, and x, x, x along that side, so it's again x, x. And for the squares, it's the same story. So you just need to take the product of the light-colored operators, and that gives you the product of those checks is the product of the logical operators. Now, at the same time, while we're doing that, that's going to anti-commute with some of the checks that we had before. So, for example, if I measure this light-colored green check, it'll anti-commute with both of the Z-type checks on these kind of half octagons here. So what we have to do is we have to get rid of one of them and replace the other by the product of the two of them, which gives a full octagon check there that fuses them together. So we'll measure the full octagon check, Z check, and while we're at it, we'll measure the full octagon X check for fault tolerance. And if you do the counting, you'll see that turns out the total number of qubits you need if you allocated one syndrome qubit per face is the same as you would need for two logical qubits for doing the CNOT gate. And
can you say again where the border between the things that you're fusing is?
Yeah, so it's a little strange because while they're triangles, they're sort of, you know, kind of deformed, right, in this funny lattice. So along one side, perhaps this is too crude an instrument for this. So I'll try the laser here. So one,
this would be laser
two. Surgery. This is, yeah, that's right. This is laser surgery, right? So one, two, three. That's one side of this triangle. Another side of the triangle is one, two, three, and the third side is one, two, three.
So you're just adding on that little piece to what?
So I'm just. This is the side of this triangle, and here's the side of the other triangle, and I want to measure x x x x x x, right?
Yeah, but where? I'm just trying to understand. You're just fusing on little pieces to other little pieces. Is that, or I thought it was like big pieces that you're putting together?
No, just take two of these. We're going to do an MXX between a pair of these. So the central one and this one, say, and that's it. So ignore these other ones here. Okay, they're not there. Perhaps I shouldn't have compressed so much into one slide. But
okay.
So just these two, for example, let's focus on that pair. And the way
but
we
these
do,
are, but these are very. I mean, these are have very little error.
For distance three, it's, you know,
This
is distance three because the minimum weight of a logical operator is the length of any side of this triangle, which is three. Over here, the distance, so the side of the triangle is one, two, three, four, five.
Okay.
That's distance five. And similarly here, it's one, two, three, four, five, distance five. And so I'm trying to kind of take the two sides and bring them together, both of distance five. And the way we do that is we measure this green check and that green check, and the product of them gives us what we want. But we will also, at the same time, measure the X and the Z check in the octagons that get fused together.
Yeah.
And they'll commute with the things. Yeah.
That part I was fine. It's trying to figure out what is getting fused together.
So the picture on the left is steam code.
Yeah. So the smallest color code is the steam code. So you can think of the color codes as a way of generalizing the steam code in a way that's maybe a little bit more clever than concatenation. It's the first part of a lattice, and it grows. And interestingly enough, for all three of those lattices that I showed for the color code, the smallest one is the steam code. So those are like three different ways of growing the steam code in a kind of uniform tiling. So you get all of the beautiful properties that the steam code has that got people excited about concatenated codes back in the day. But you also get the benefit of being able to put this in a lattice, in a 2D lattice, without having to worry about this hierarchical structure and the difficulties associated with it. Okay, and the last comment I had here about these Digon checks, these ones that are just weight two. So I've drawn them here. This is a green check. I've got it in the green face. But you could imagine reusing the syndrome bit in the center here to measure this check. So you could sort of, if you will, fold in these Digon checks so that they just reuse the syndrome bit in the middle. Again, if we're trying to be stingy with qubits, including the syndrome qubits, that might be something we'd want to do. Yes?
Which one's the target, which one's the extra one, and what's the fourth one there for?
We haven't done, okay, so I haven't described the CNOT yet. I'm describing a primitive, which is the MXX or the MZZ. My next set of slides is going to walk through exactly how we do the CNOT gate with these. Absolutely, yeah. This is an important slide to understand here. So are there any other questions? If you're uncertain about anything, please ask. Is there a question? So you just pick a pair of these. So you pick like this one and this one. And in the end, you would just have the set of qubits that are associated with two logical
qubits.
Yeah.
The green edge and on that top diagonal and then a blue edge.
Yeah.
Green blue.
Yeah, it would just be that. Or it could just be this here, something like that. Remember, we have two logical qubits, but we're measuring an operator between them, MXX. So it's like half of a Bell measurement, if you will. So we don't have two full logical qubits degree of freedom anymore because we've got a joint measurement between them. So there's really kind of one logical degree of freedom left after we do that logical XX measurement. So there are many different possibilities. At the least, if you want to be really minimal, you can imagine one roving syndrome qubit that moves around to, from face to face as needed. But that will take you a very long time. You could swap it if you wanted to stay in 2D and swap it around wherever it needs to go, do the measurement, swap it around. That's the least. But of course, it takes you a very long time. We don't want to do that. Next step up, maybe you could allocate a single syndrome qubit per face and use it for double duty to measure both the X-check and the Z-check for each face. So we could do that. Next step up, we could allocate two syndrome qubits per face, one for the X-checks and one for the Z-check, so that we could do both the X-check and Z-check measurements in parallel. For better performance, we could imagine allocating CAT states for the faces, where we could allocate, for example, in your paper, you talk about using in the octagons five qubits to do a verified 4-cat in the center of the octagons, and 2 cats, I think, used in the center of the squares, which you don't need to verify because they're just 2 cats. So you could do that. For even more performance improvement, you could use a Shor-style syndrome extraction where you use a cat state equal to the size of the check. So you could use 8 cats and 4 cats if you wanted to for even more qubits. Or you could use Steen-style, which uses the same number of qubits. For even more qubits, you could use syndrome qubits, you could use Nill-style syndrome extraction where you double the number of those to use a Bell state and you very quickly extract the syndrome. So it's really a trade space. It depends on what you want to do. Yes, it does. So in a paper that we'll be posting shortly, we compare it to the natural things to compare to. So in your study of the lattice surgery, you considered one syndrome qubit per face, so then which is the same as one syndrome qubit per check. So we compare that, and you'll see later, too, in this talk, we compare that to using one syndrome qubit per face for the color codes and also one syndrome qubit per check, which is 2 per face. And compare both of those, and you know, I don't know. It's trying to make the best of an apples and apples comparison. You know, it's difficult, but yeah. Okay. In fact, to make a fair comparison to that lattice surgery idea, the way you would do it for surface codes is you would measure XX, let's say, along this interface, and ZZ along this interface. For surface codes, you can only do XX along one of the directions, but not the other, and similarly for the ZZ. So you don't have this freedom of doing it on any one of the sides that you have for the color codes. But it's sufficient to do what you want to do. And to make the comparison even fairer, we actually compressed a little bit your construction that you had in your paper there. You can bring these in just a little bit and make it similar to the protocol we're talking about where you just measure the checks. You don't need to have an extra row of actual data qubits in between. The price you pay is that the orientation of the lattice, this ancillary lattice in between, is different. The sort of colorability, black, green becomes red and red becomes green. But you can do that and save just a little bit. So try to make the fairest comparison possible. So here's how we do the CNOT gate. So you know, in addition to a 6-year-old who likes Lego movies, I have a 2-year-old who I read Cat in the Hat things to. So you know, doing a CNOT is easy, you see. It's as simple as spelling C-A-T. We have a control, an ancilla, and a target here. And so this will be the layout that we're going to do for doing a CNOT gate. And you can see here how we're going to do that. So we'll be mimicking this circuit here. And those are the 3 logical qubits we use to do that. So here it is. We're going to trace through this circuit that I said is the theoretical underpinning of this method in 4 steps. So in the first step, what we'll do is we'll prepare the ancilla out of nothing. So we'll want to prepare it in a 0 state. So each of these blue dots indicate that we prepare them in z eigenstates. And then we measure the checks for that code d times. So we do that to prepare it fault tolerantly. Then the next step, we want to measure xx. So we fuse along this direction. We're measuring xx between the ancilla and the target. So there's our little legend, the ancilla to target. So we'll measure xx along there. We hold that for d rounds. And then we split it, and we hold that for d rounds to kind of heal that interface, you know, to keep everything nice and fault tolerant. Then we measure zz between the ancilla and the control, and we hold that for d rounds. And then we split it, and we let that interface heal for another d rounds. And then finally, we measure x, which I said we do destructively, and we do that in just a single step. But we would actually, we just do that in a single step. So there's the protocol. We can optimize this quite a bit. Maybe I should ask first, though, does this protocol make sense to folks before I talk about how to optimize this? OK, great. So the first thing we can get rid of is this this step here, because this idea of where we prepare this, we measure this for d rounds, and then we follow it by fusing it with this side here, we can combine those into a single operation, which is kind of like taking the target and just expanding it into this region in just a total of D steps. There's no reason to prepare this and then fuse it into it. You can think of it as maybe a single growing of the target qubit into a larger encoding. So in just D steps, we can do that. So we get rid of D steps from there. We can also get rid of part where we heal this interface and then fuse this interface. It turns out because they're two different sides, we can be healing this and fusing that at the same time. They don't interfere with one another. So in a single D steps, we're healing on the left, but we're fusing on the right. Not a problem. They don't interfere. Next, we can combine the split and the measure operation here. So where we, after we do this fusion, we heal this for D rounds and then we measure it. Well, we can just measure it. But instead of doing D rounds here and then follow it by one round there, we do this measurement, but we still have to heal this interface here. So it just takes, it doesn't save as much as the other ones. And so instead of taking time D plus one, it takes just time D. So we can fold those together. And lastly, this preparation step we can combine with the measurement step, and you know, so we're ready to do it again if we like. In fact, you could, since we're measuring the x basis, you could imagine this is the preparation for the other circuit that you used the plus there for, or you could simply do a, you know, a transversal Hadamard if you like on those, which doesn't take any measurement time at all, and you're back to the sort of initial preparation up there. So the upshot of all this is that the time it takes to do a C-naught is 3D rounds for distance D, which is quite a bit shorter than it would be for defects.
On step three, when you do this in parallel, fusion and healing, do you lose on the distance effectively or not?
No, I'm only allowing myself to do compressions here that do not drop the distance. It's very important not to do that. Yeah.
Just a quick comment.
Yeah.
When you say it's shorter than
Well, I'll be talking about that. I've got it quantified in some later slides, yeah. If you'll indulge me for a minute, let me finish the logical gate set, and I'll get to that. So if we want to do the phase gate in our universal gate set, well, for surface codes, the phase gate is not automatic. You have to do some work to get it. It's typically done by teleportation, and you can do it in a kind of non-catalytic teleportation way, where you prepare this S plus state, and then you've teleported the S gate, but now your ancillary magic state has disappeared. Or you could do it in a catalytic way, where you still have the magic state after you've done the teleportation, but the cost is that the teleportation itself is a bit more of an elaborate circuit. It takes a little bit more time. This is just one C-naught in a measurement. Here we've got a C-naught, a Hadamard, and a C-naught. And in order to do this, we have to define protocols for doing these preparation procedures first, which I'll be doing. Now, however you do this, by hook or by crook, it's certainly longer than the time it takes for a color code, which is zero rounds of measurement. You just apply the S-gate transversely, boom, you're done. That is radically faster than the time it would take to do it with surface codes. It's even faster than it takes the time it takes to do it with defects in color codes, because with defects in color codes, what you do is you take the three defects, you deform them and move them together so that they just touch on the corners here, kind of isolating a little triangular patch in the middle. Then you do the zero time S gate, and then you deform the three defects back to where they started again. So moving them there is D steps and moving them back is D steps. So it took you 2D time. Whereas for this transversal, this lattice surgery picture, zero time in terms of measurement. So much, much faster. For the Hadamard gate, to do it fault tolerantly with a surface code with the transversal picture, you have to do a sequence of steps that take 6D time. So you would take your little patch, grow it around the corner so that the logical sides kind of go like an L shape like this. And then you would take the red side here and make it go stretch along the bottom, and then shrink it and compress it and move it out. And there's a whole sequence of steps here. I won't go through the whole song and dance, but take 6D time steps to do that. If you don't like doing that, you could do an alternative. There's a circuit, I was just talking with John about this yesterday. There's a circuit that, well, I do the Hadamard gate that just uses the S gate and C naught gate and a plus preparation procedures that we've already talked about. But if you want to do this, remember we have to do the non-catalytic S because the catalytic S required the H gate. We can't use, this is a sort of chicken and egg problem. We can't use that to do the Hadamard gate if we didn't have the Hadamard gate. So you could implement the Hadamard gate that way if you wanted to. Again, kind of costly. If you wanted to do it in the lattice picture, then you basically are mimicking this a procedure like this above. You or turning the double defect encoding into this little patch and doing a dance and putting it back together again. I'm not exactly sure how much time this takes. I had a hard time gathering this from the papers. I asked Austin. He told me 5D time, but he didn't optimize it. Maybe it can be optimized some. I don't know. 2.5D. Okay. So you can compress it down to 2.5D, but whatever it is, it's not zero, which is what you get with color codes. So with color codes, you just apply the Hadamard transversely, and you're done. So it's much, much faster. Yes?
Just do a transversal Hadamard permute for the surface codes. Do you
change the order of your... So you do the transversal Hadamard, but what's happened is your logical X and your logical Z have reversed. They're not back to the same orientation they were. So you need to have some mechanism to put it back. And most of what these extra steps are all about are doing that, putting it, you know, getting the orientation right through kind of various swapping of information around and turning the bend and all that. Yeah, so in fact, this sort of L-shaped thing here that's going on, or like this L-shaped thing here, that's all about kind of turning it, you know, turning it so that the you've done that 90-degree rotation. Yeah. And for the Hadamard in color codes with defects, it's again like this, but you have to pay the price for the movement in and the movement out. Okay, so the last instruction is a state injection, this T plus thing. How do we do that? So what we do is we take our state that we want to inject, we have it here in the corner, and we prepare an auxiliary state that's a color code state, stabilizer state, not a code, but it's a sort of a smaller distance here. And then we measure the checks that would fuse it together to become a color code. Now, since this initial preparation is only good to probability P, say, with a depolarizing channel noise, you're never going to get any better than that. You could maybe encode it so it's a very well-protected state that's off by probability P, but you're never going to do any better than that. So there's no need to repeat error correction in this auxiliary surface any more than three rounds to give you P squared kind of error suppression. There's no reason to do any more than that. So it just takes you a constant number, three rounds of error correction to prepare this thing here. So instead of doing D, you know, here we just do three. And then we do three rounds to fuse the thing in. And what happens is, so if you trace this, if we look at, say, the logical X operator on this qubit here, when we go to measure the check, it'll this blue check here, it'll anti-commute with the Z check that we measure here. So we have to replace it with a prod. It also, but this blue check also anti-commutes with the X check that we had been measuring before. So what we do is we get rid of the X check here that we'd been measuring before and replace the logical X on this qubit with it times the product of it times this X check here. And we end up getting X, 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 X. So it grows that logical X along the side. And this argument continues. We could pushes it all the way up along this side here. And it'll take the logical X for the single qubit and go zoop and push it all the way up to the top. And the logical Z, same thing, zoop, it pushes it all the way along the top here. There's some funny business that happens here on every other odd distance where we have these little kind of hats on the top, these little digons. These digons, remember we have XX and ZZ on those. That's just a Bell state. So we kind of have kind of a large code and then a Bell state hanging around. And in fact, it's a pair of Bell states because although this looks like a square, if I multiplied this square by this Bell state, these Bell state checks, I just get another Bell state there. So there's a pair there. In this case, the D equals 3 is kind of special. You might just do post-selection to prepare this one just because it's such a small case. But for higher cases, you would do this Bell state preparation in a way, just do the post-selection on the Bell state part, and then the rest you would do the three rounds of error correction for. So we came up with a similar protocol for doing this in the surface code. You can inject it here where you have your state, you create some smaller surface code patches, and then you measure all the checks and you put it in. And it just takes six rounds total. So let me give you a resource recap. And this is where we're comparing to the surface codes here. So compared to surface codes, they use half the qubits approximately to get the same distance and less than or equal to the number of measurement rounds per the distance. So if the big wins here are the Hadamard and the S-gate. They go from 6D and 12D. And maybe you're telling me it's 2.5D. Okay. I'm sorry. This is for the, I'm comparing to the lattice surgery method. It goes down to zero. And the number of qubits, if you do the formulas, it's roughly half. And that kind of makes sense because a triangle is kind of half the number of qubits as a square. You know, you can sort of take a little triangle out of a square. So there's a big savings here in terms of qubits per distance. But it turns out this isn't the whole story, because the question we want to answer is, well, what's the overhead to achieve a fixed level of error suppression? And even though the code distance is less, it turns out that the threshold is lower for surface codes too. So you have to bump up the distance of the color code to get the same level of error suppression as you would for a surface code. And do you win or do you lose with that game? That's the question we want to answer. And to be precise about that, we need an error model and a syndrome decoding algorithm to answer that. For error models, they generally come in three flavors. You can either talk about the setting where data qubits are subject to error, the setting where data qubits and syndrome qubits are subject to error, or the setting where both of those and the circuit elements themselves are subject to error. And I'm going to consider a depolarizing noise, where we assume the noise acts ideally followed by, or the gates operations act ideally followed by a random non-identity poly operation with probability p. And for measurements, we also have this trick where we have to flip the outcome of with probability p as well, because a measurement error is when a measurement is inconsistent with the data. So we actually have to flip the classical tape as well in the model. This model's got a lot of problems with it, I know, but it's widely used, and so I'm using it to compare to the rest of the world. There are any number of syndrome decoding algorithms for surface codes and color codes. Generally, they're Sharpe-Hard, shown by David Poulon and collaborators. Sergey Bravi and collaborators came up with a PEPS decoder for the surface code that's linear. And I'm very excited about that. And I think it's an interesting question whether or not we can generalize that to the color codes to get a linear time decoder for the color codes that performs well or approximates the optimal one very well. There's a variety of matching-based decoders you can use for the surface code. And for the color codes, you can use an integer program decoder that will find the most likely error given the syndrome, which turns out not to be the same thing as a matching-based decoder for the color codes. Those are a bit weaker. And of course, you can also just hijack any surface code decoder by using the identification of a color code with some number of copies of the surface code. And anyway, this is a whole long list of decoders. Many of you in the audience here have developed these. I apologize if I've missed some of them. You can come talk to me afterwards, but there are many decoders. So the overhead then, we need to have an expression for how the failure probability of the encoded operation depends on P and D. And it turns out there isn't an easy answer for coming up with this formula. It depends on what the relative magnitude of P and D are. There's a paper by Watson and Barrett, for example, that show that there's a qualitatively different scaling law that takes force when D is less than 1 over 4P or D is greater than 1 over 4P. And so we have to be mindful of that. And we get these very beautiful formulas that work in the code capacity and phenomenological models. But for the circuit model, it's not so easy to come up with such a beautiful formula. We're kind of stuck with looking at numerics. And something that seems to fit the data well, again by Austin and collaborators, is the scaling law of P over P threshold of the D over 2. And we've heard arguments yesterday from Daniel Leonid and others about why there's a percolation argument as to why the failure probability should scale something like this. So color code increase that we need scales something like this. And if we assume that this coefficient in front, this A of D, is similar for color codes and surface codes, I don't know exactly what it is, but whatever it is, it's going to be some constant times D to probably the same power for both of them. And if I take the log of their ratio, that's going to be a fairly small number. I'll neglect this term in here to make the analysis simpler so that the color code distance is related to the surface code distance times basically this ratio that depends on the thresholds of the two codes. So the one thing that seems to be not awesome about color codes is that the threshold estimates range between 0.082% and 0.143%, whereas for surface codes, they range between 0.502% and 1.14%. And so how do we compare these? Well, I've compared them in the two different extremes. So I've given the most favorable threshold for the color code and the least favorable one for the surface code and looked at the overhead of the two and compared them. And so whenever the ratio is less than one, it means that color codes are using fewer qubits than surface codes to achieve the same error rate. And so you can see here as the distance increases, when I get down to about like distance 11 here, for all higher distances, I'm using fewer qubits for the color codes as long as P is less than, say, 10 to the minus 5. So if your error rate per operation is less than 10 to the minus 5 and your distance is 11 or greater, color codes are the way to go. You want to use that. They're going to use fewer qubits. On the more pessimistic side, from my point of view, If you give the worst threshold, the worst reported threshold for the color codes and the best one for the surface codes, then you're at like, I don't know, 10 to the minus 7, 10 to the minus 8, something like that, before you start seeing an improvement of color codes over surface codes. Yes?
So this is still neglecting ancilla qubits.
This is counting ancilla qubits. I'm counting the ancilla qubits, and this is using, so the expressions I used, let's see. So I gave the formula for this. I did not, and then this table here that I reported I'm using these formulas. So this is allocating one syndrome per face and one syndrome per face. So that's what I'm using.
So I guess one question I have then, even when we used 5 qubits for the octagons, we could still only get half the code distance for the color code.
Okay.
So it makes a big difference.
Okay. That's right. So and that is this estimate of the threshold that's 0.082% corresponds to using one per face. That estimate was done with that in that setting. So that's over here, for example. Now, what I want, I mean, room for improvement. So what we really want to do, which is maybe getting to your question, is that finite D.
But what I'm saying is it's more than that. It's not just the threshold. It's the fact you don't get the full code distance.
You don't get the full code distance.
It's very hard to take a single syndrome qubit, which can splatter 4 errors on random data qubits and get full code distance.
Okay.
Because one error becomes many.
So I guess I would say that the thing we want to do at finite code sizes is to not look at, even use the notion of a threshold. The threshold is something in asymptopia that happens. What we're interested in for finite code sizes is looking at the actual overhead for each P, and that removes the need to do any kind of fitting like this and make any arguments of getting, quote, the full code distance, by which presumably you mean that we get to use the variable D as opposed to some other variable up there, like the fraction of D. So in the simulations that I did for getting this 0.082%, we just used the color code distances as they were, ran the IP decoder, and got a scaling law like this, and fit that to calculate this 0.082%.
That's the threshold. You need to look well below the threshold to get how many errors you actually.
Again, so when we get to these finite cases, the small error cases, which we looked at even in this, we were looking at those small errors, then you have to really just calculate the overhead and not even try to fit it to a scaling law. You need to just count what's the overhead in these low cases. Okay.
Sorry, yes. I feel like this is not the right. So first of all, that horizontal axis is the P, not the P fell, right?
The horizontal is the P. That's correct. Okay. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But I mean, so in a situation where you say, well, I have this target value of P fell, and I have P, then you don't say, oh, but I'm going to use this distance code no matter what P fell is and P is. You say, well, given these values, what is the best distance that I should use?
Mm-hmm.
So you shouldn't be comparing, I mean, this is kind of what Austin was saying. You shouldn't be comparing distance, what a D color code versus a distance D surface code. You say for each code, what is the optimal for the thing that I'm trying to achieve, and then compare the overhead.
So what I'm trying to do is figure out the fewest qubits needed to achieve P fail. So you tell me what P fail you want to have, right?
But I don't see that on this.
So the way that would work is you would say, okay, I want a desired level of P fail, and I want to ask what, and my P is some number here. It's fixed, okay?
Yeah.
Let's say, and so by changing the distance, I can achieve P fail. I can achieve the same level, P fail, with the color code of the surface code along this, let's see, so along this line here for distance 3 and then distance 5, et cetera. So as I increase the distance, yes, I get...
At some point, increasing the distance is going to make the overhead worse because you're adding more distance than you need to achieve this P fail.
That's true. So
that's not going to show up in this graph here.
Yeah, so this is showing for giving for showing a the same p fail for both codes, but you're saying, well, the p fail you want would be changing in each of these cases because the distance is changing because you'd be suppressing it more.
Well, sort of. I mean, I'm thinking the other way around, that you shouldn't be comparing codes of the same distance because what distance you want to use depends on the code to get the best. I mean, you want to pick the best distance to fail that you're trying to get.
Right. Right. So I guess here what I'm plotting is for the same distance for both codes, and you're saying, well, I should look at different distances for the two codes to get the...
maybe, you know, for the PFL I want, D equals 19 is not nearly good enough, and I should be going to D equals 50.
Right.
Or maybe actually I'm better off at D equals 5, and I should be looking at the D equals 5 curve rather than D equals 19 curve.
Right.
That doesn't seem captured at all in this presentation.
Yeah, so I could generate more plots to show you these kinds of these features. Yeah. So what I was just trying to get at here was to ask if I were to fix p fail to be some number and basically take this expression for the color code and equate it for the surface code and say, okay, and use the fact that the use this relationship here. So I say, if I'm going to choose this distance for the surface code, then I choose this distance for the color code to get the same level of error suppression. So that is this question. So p-fail, if ds gives me a certain level of p-fail, then dc gives me that same level of p-fail, which is larger than ds. Mm-hmm. So that is this issue. That's what I'm comparing. So this is, so this ratio here is omega c over omega s is the function where I use in the numerator the p-fail formula using dc, and in the denominator I use it using ps. So I am using a different distance for both codes, okay. And they're related by this expression here, which arguably is something that's only valid in asymptopia because it's some assumed scaling law. But I am comparing two different distances because I do need two different distances to give me the same p-fail.
Okay.
So I am doing that in these plots.
I see, okay. But there's no notion here of what actually is the best distance to look at for a given p-fail because you're imagining p-fail as extremely, extremely small.
I'm just equating it. It drops out. I mean, whatever p-fail is, I'm not plotting it here. It drops out because I'm saying I want the same p-fail for the two codes. What, you know, if
the value of p-fail tells you which of those curves you should be looking at.
Yes, it does. That's right, because p-fail is a function of that distance. If I fix p, it's a function of that distance.
Yeah.
So that's right. So each of these curves corresponds to a different p-fail, if you like. That's right. And so whatever p-fail you want is, you know, dictated by the curve. That's right.
So which d is labeling the curves? DC or DS?
DS. DS is labeling the curves. I should have written that. Sorry about that. These are DSs.
If you keep the distance fixed and change the error probability, you cannot keep the same p-fail. The p-fail must be changing along the lines.
The same
no.
Curves. No, it's same for both codes.
Yeah.
Perhaps, but it will be changing a lot of the lives. So let's say what p failed to.
Yes, as p changed. Yeah, it's this. It's this expression here. So yeah. So p fail depends on both p and d. That's right. So, but if we fixed a p, which is what I think Daniel was asking, if we fixed p, then you would need, and each of those different d's corresponds to a different p fail that you get from this relationship going down.
I just find it a confusing way.
You can add a curve to those, say, you know, fixing the p-fail to, let's say, 1%, and just plotting for different distances where they would sit.
Yeah, perhaps what I could do is present this as a series of graphs where I look at different slices along this to show, and then slices along that. I probably tried to put too much information in a single plot here, and I apologize for that. If you're interested in fixing p, and changing p fail, well, it changes with d as you do this. And if you're looking at the ratio of the overheads as d changes, that's what this would give you. Or if you're interested in fixing the p fail, then you're walking along one of these curves here, and p, d and p are changing. Okay, yes, we're over on time here. Okay, so there's the plots. I'm happy to talk more with you about it afterwards, I guess. And the end, I just want to say the best thing to do is forget all this curve fitting nonsense. Let's just calculate the overhead for each P and see what it is and compare it for one versus the other. So, you know, given a P fail, what did I need for the overhead? And calculate those ratios, and that'll really give us the answer for small sizes. That's all I had to say. Thank you very much. Yes?
Do we know how much room there for improvement there is in decoding color codes? Like, are the threshold estimates really far away from bounds, or?
There aren't really any good bounds. I mean, they could be improved. Yeah, I think there's a lot of room for improvement for them. For example, the recent decoder by Bravi, Suchara, and Vargo, they find that by using this PEPS decoder, that they can suppress the logical failure rate by a factor of 100 by using the optimal decoder against the depolarizing noise versus using the matching-based decoder. Well, a factor of 100 is a big deal. And can we do that for the color codes? I don't know, but we have to see. So I think it's fair to say that surface codes are more well-studied than color codes, and so it's a bit more mature, the understanding of the threshold there. But for color codes, I don't know. There is a mapping. If you're interested in just the code capacity or the phenomenological model, just like the surface code, there are these equivalencies to associated statistical mechanical models. And then you can actually get very good estimates for the thresholds in those cases. And in fact, they're better for color codes than surface codes. But those are unfair in the sense that they're using weight 8. They're saying like measuring a weight 8 check is as easy as measuring a weight 4 check. And that's not really fair. It's going to be harder to measure the weight 8 check. And that's, I think, why the threshold gets worse when you actually look at the detailed circuit to try to extract a weight 8 check. Suddenly, there's this reversal of fortunes. I mean, it's strange. If you look at the code capacity setting, color codes win over surface codes. You look at the phenomenological, color codes win over surface codes. So you're getting all excited, ready for the circuit model, and then, boom, you know, the rug gets pulled out from under you, and the color codes do worse by about a factor of 10, give or take. But, you know, maybe that could be brought up. Yeah?
I guess in the statistical model, you could weigh the weight of these multi-body operators by their weight. I mean, by their size. And that would sort of account for the fact that they're harder to measure.
Yeah.
I don't think no one has done that.
Yeah, you could give it a to approximate it. I mean, the...
If you say that the failure rate will be proportional to the number of C-naughts in the measurement, you could do that.
Yeah, I mean, even better, what you could do is you could take a given set of physical gates you might be imagining using to extract the syndrome and simulate an error model on that and use that to populate the phenomenology that you're doing, you're using this phenomenological model for. And so, and that should have a kind of a translational invariance to it. It might be because there'll be some correlations induced by the checks, it might be a little bit of a larger scale than just a single check, but eventually there will be a cutoff of that and you could tile that around. And so, and then there's some admittedly unusual stat-mech model that you could use to estimate the threshold. Yeah. That might be what this auto-tune kind of thing does. Is that?
No, auto-tune is gate-based. So I would never personally do that because I would always just study the gates directly. Because error propagation matters a lot. When you have one error and a whole bunch of C-naught that scatters the errors everywhere, that's the behavior that auto-tune captures, and that's the behavior that sets the threshold. And that's why it's so much love. It's the most important thing. So I would never personally throw it out and study a static.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks.